This is our last military history presentation for the year. We always have these end-of-year presentations from Dennis. He likes the year to think about it, but he comes up with some pretty amazing topics. So, really, without further ado, most of you will know Dennis O'Rourke, who has been presenting to us over quite a bit of time. Come on, Dennis.
It always amuses me when Joe talks about the emergency exits. It's a case of, if something happens, follow me.
Yeah.
Right, better put my glasses on, because without glasses, it's a waste of time. This presentation is just an overview of a huge and complex subject. The German Air Force's, the Luftwaffe's fight against the aircraft of the Royal Air Force's Bomber Command at night between late 1939 and early 1945. It was a bitter battle fought in the skies over Western Europe. It was a technical battle from a scientific point of view in the fields of radio and radar, as well as developmental in respect of the aircraft flown and the tactics used. The presentation ignores the civilian casualties suffered, but does touch on the military casualties in both the Luftwaffe and Bomber Command. I'll try and give you a balanced overview of the battle, which has since, in respect particularly of Bomber Command's involvement, has become the subject of revisionist history. I'll try and cover the following in my presentation, but it's quite an overview. There is a view that the art of night fighting in the air, and in the beginning it was more of an art than a system, began in World War II, but that's not so. Towards the end of the First World War, all of the combatants started to evolve a system to combat night aerial intruders in their airspace. In respect of Britain's Royal Flying Corps, later the Royal Air Force, this involved single and two-seater canvas and string aircraft versus, in the first instance, Zeppelin airships raiding England, then Gotha bombers, and also over the Western Front in France and Belgium against German Air Force intruder aircraft over their airfields and trenches. This war involved, besides the aircraft, listening posts, searchlights and anti-aircraft guns, later referred to as FLAC, Archie in the First World War. Those elements did not change in the early days of World War II, some 20 years later. The air forces involved in these aerial battles of the First World War included the British, French and Italian, as well as the Germans and Austrians. The tactics they evolved were very similar, starting with individual pilots flying the night skies hoping to come across an enemy aircraft, to eventually cooperating with the searchlights and listening posts to find their prey. Intelligence and pure luck also played a significant part. The British shot down six airships and started to build up their night victories over the Western Front. The German Air Force also scored victories against British and French bombers over their territory. In the Spanish Civil War, the German Air Force, also known as the Condor Legion, used Heinkel biplane fighters in a night fighting experiment, but without success, as there were no electronic aids to assist them. The Great Depression of the 1930s also hindered development in this area. The British view was that the bomber will always get through, and that focused the RAF's night flying on bombers rather than fighters. The Luftwaffe, the German Air Force, conducted night fighter experiments as early as the middle of 1937, which involved a line of listening devices in front of a series of lines of searchlights. The fighter orbited a light beacon until advised that the enemy bomber had entered the searchlight lit area. And this was basically the setup that was used in the early days of the war. Both Britain and Germany worked on radar in the few years preceding World War II. Britain built the chain home system, which was fortunately up and running before the Battle of Britain. They also developed a fighter control system, which many claim won the Battle of Britain. And this evolved into a system controlling the RAF's night fighters during the Blitz and beyond. At the beginning of the war, the German Air Force, the Luftwaffe, had very few aircraft dedicated to night fighting. Initially, these few were Messerschmitt Bf 109Ds, obsolescent single-engine fighters. Due to a very limited night campaign in the early days by Bomber Command, there were very few incursions into their airspace, and the British lost only 7 aircraft in the last 4 months of 1939. But pilots of the German Air Force were thinking about how to counter the British night incursions. In the first months of the war, Bomber Command flew few sorties over Germany, distributing mostly leaflets rather than bombs, providing the Germans with enough toilet paper to last them throughout the war, according to some sources. This British statement of intent, which I would suggest was the focus of the Royal Air Force's Bomber Command up to the end of the war in 1945. This was a campaign which cost the Royal Air Force 7,449 missing bombers and also a further 13,778 damaged bombers. It also cost a total of 47,125 British bomber crewmen their lives on operations and a further 8,090 on non-operational crashes. These losses included 1,668 members of the Royal New Zealand Air Force. Following on from this statement of intent by the British planners, they embarked on a huge program of bomber aircraft manufacture, airfield construction, and aircrew training, which imposed a very significant strain on the economy and manpower and woman power, and adversely affected the re-equipping and manning programs of both the British Army in particular, and also the Royal Navy. These aircraft bore the brunt of the night bombing campaign until the four-engine heavies, the Stirling, the Halifax and the Lancaster, entered the fray. In the early days, the German defence centred on flak, anti-aircraft artillery and searchlights situated around the major cities and towns of Germany. Later on, the night fighters went to work over the target being attacked, but this had very limited success as there was conflict with the flak organisation and friendly fighters were often coned by the searchlights and shot at by their friendly flak. In the early days, navigation to the target by Bomber Command aircraft over a blacked-out wartime landscape was extremely poor, as well as bombing accuracy if the target city, let alone the military target in that city, could be found. As a consequence, the bombing campaign was being criticised as a waste of resources. The Butt report analysed 600 photographs of raids in the previous 3 months and found that only a third of the bomber crews that claimed to have reached their targets had actually dropped their bombs within 5 miles, 8 kilometres of the target. The father of the Luftwaffe's night fighter force, the Nachtjahr, was Wolfgang Falk. He was a leading Zestora ME-110 pilot who fought in the Polish and French campaigns flying that aircraft, twin-engined heavy fighter. This aircraft was the premier night fighter for the Germans throughout the war and was the preferred aircraft of most of the aces. It initially had a crew of 2, a pilot and a gunner, but later the crew could also include a radar operator. Falk devised early tactics and promoted his point of view to the Luftwaffe's leadership, but was ignored. From mid-1940, The RAF responded to the German attacks in the west by initiating a bomber campaign on German towns. The failure to defend against these raids embarrassed the German leadership and led to the acceptance of Foch's suggestions. He was directed to form the first night fighter group as NJG1, that's Nachtjagdgeschwader 1, and control previously vested in the searchlight regiments gave rise to an equal partnership. In July, the command of night fighting, both the fighters and the searchlights, was vested in the then Colonel, later Major General, Kammhuber. Kammhuber was a senior bomber unit commander and pilot. He's an interesting man. After his Himmelbett line was bested by the British, he was posted to Norway, where he was in charge of the German Air Force in Norway. And at the end of the war, I think he had about 10 planes left, but he ended up rejoining the Luftwaffe when the Germans came back into the western area and ended up as the inspector of the Luftwaffe. So. Kammhuber went to work with a vengeance, putting together a night fighter control organisation which involved the flying arm, radar sites and stations where ground-based fighter controllers were situated. Each station controlled the box, which was patrolled by one or two night fighters. At the same time, Luftwaffe heavy fighters intruded into English airspace to attack the aircraft and aerodromes they came across. The drawback in respect of the Himmelbett box was that only one or two fighters could be directed onto intruding bombers at any one time. At that time, then, the guns and searchlights were repositioned around the cities and towns of Germany. The Freya radar that you can see in the photograph there was for the long-range detection of incoming bombers. There were two Wurzburgs. One was to track the target bomber, and the second Wurzburg was to track the night fighter. The ground controller utilised the radar information on a plotting table. As the RAF sent more bombers into German airspace and only one or two may be intercepted in the box, the other bombers entering the box at the same time would not be intercepted, though they would again face the night fighters as they headed back home. The bomber stream was put in place in May 1942 to overcome the Himmelbett line by saturation, which it did successfully. Taken into consideration at the time was the probability of collisions, but aircraft were allocated different flight levels and timings in the bomber stream. As a consequence, the Himmelbett line was rendered ineffective. The night fighters were then directed into the bomber stream to hunt individually. At this time, the fighters were being fitted with airborne radar, which, when in the bomber stream, enabled them to hunt individual bombers. When in the stream, they were in effect in a target-rich environment, and some night fighter pilots started to build up significant victory scores. Several expert pilots shooting down seven bombers in one night in the course of the campaign. In the middle of 1942, there were 3,000 bomber raids on German cities. Cologne with 1,047 bombers, Essen with 956 bombers, and Bremen with 960. In my view, this was primarily a public relations exercise designed by Air Marshal Harris to demonstrate the power of Bomber Command. These raids included aircraft from the operational training units, and for the Bremen raid included aircraft from the Day Bomber Force and Coastal Command. The first of these raids introduced the bomber stream and the use of window. In February 1944, nearly 900 bombers raided Berlin, and with other missions on that same night, more than 1,000 bombers were active. The German defences were totally overwhelmed by the raid on Cologne. This is an ME-110 fitted with radar. Now, the bulky aerials arrays imposed reductions in speed. The radar could get the fighter into visual distance from its target bomber, and it was then up to the pilot to fly the fighter into an attacking position. They were also assisted by the ability to track the bomber's H2S ground tracking radar and Monica tail warning radar emissions. The preferred attack profile was to get close enough to the bomber and shoot at the wing between the engines. This would ignite a fuel tank. If that was achieved, the bomber was doomed. Firing at the fuselage was problematic. It could explode the bomb load of the target, which would cause the destruction of both aircraft, and on occasions it did so. Eventually, most fighters were fitted with upward-firing cannon, which is illustrated in this slide. By far the greater majority of these cases, the attacking fighter was not detected by any of the bomber's gunners, and the attack would have come as a complete surprise. In theory, the night fighters were allowed to attack the bombers over the target at a certain height, and the flak would not fire to that height. Often, of course, that did not happen, and the fighters were engaged by their own friendly flak. This was in the main the hunting ground of the single-engine night fighters, which joined the battle after the demise of the Himmelbett line. Bomber Command's worst night was on the night of the 30th, 31st of March 1944. On a clear moonlight night, Bomber Command launched a raid on the city of Nuremberg, deep in southern Germany. The night fighters got into the bomber stream early on, and the bombers suffered the highest losses of the war, while the target was barely damaged. Out of 795 aircraft which took place in the raid, 95 were shot down. This was the highest loss on any one raid during the course of the war, 11.9% of the bombers which were involved. Taking an example of 100 airmen in Bomber Command, 55 of those would be killed on operations or died as a result of wounds. 3 were injured on operations or active service. 12 were taken as prisoners of war, some of whom were wounded. 2 were shot down and evaded capture. And only 27 of the 100 survived a tour of operations. Some bomber crewmen went on to complete 3 tours of operations, and they were the luckiest men alive, I think. I have read that it's estimated that 2/3 of the aircraft losses were assessed as victims of the night fighters, and the remaining 1/3 were the victims of flak, collisions, weather, etc. Something in the order of 60% of air crews who served in Bomber Command became casualties one way or another. In November 1943, 100 Group was formed in Bomber Command to consolidate electronic warfare and countermeasures. Using electronic homers and Mosquito night fighters, these aircraft targeted the Luftwaffe's night fighters and patrolled their aircraft, their airfields, to catch them taking off and landing. This constant harassment had a detrimental effect on the morale and the confidence of the Jagdwaffe, and led to a high level of aircraft crashes as the German night fighters hurried to land to avoid the Mosquito threat, real or imagined. It gave rise to what was called Mosquito panic. The Mosquitoes claimed in 1944-45 as a total of 258 Luftwaffe aircraft shot down for 70 losses. 100 Group aircraft were also involved in jamming radars and radio control frequencies. Adolf Galland, the German general that I'm sure you've all heard about, said that the combination of the Pathfinder operations of Bomber Command, the activities of 100 group with radar jamming and window, combined with intelligent tactics, caused severe problems trying to defend Germany in the air. 1944 was the worst year for both sides, but because of the shortage of fuel which impacted on the Luftwaffe, training suffered, and available aircrew for the German night fighters also suffered, as experienced crews were killed or injured. The German night fighters' efficiency and availability impacted on that campaign. As the Allies advanced across France and Belgium, the German radar availability also was greatly affected. But the German Air Force night fighters continued to cause losses to Bomber Command to the very end of the war. In the final months, a few jet night fighters were deployed, which caused losses, including the first significant losses to the Mosquitoes of Bomber Command, both the light night striking force and Hunter Group's aircraft. Too little, too late. The highest scoring German night fighter ace was Heinz Wolfgang Schnaufer, who claimed a total of 121 victories. He's seen here with his crew. He survived the war but was killed a few years later in a motor accident. To the right is a photograph of the victory markings on the tail of his ME-110. In the day fighter battles, there was a significant amount of overclaiming victories. This was generally not so in respect of the night fighter forces, because they very carefully analysed where bombers had been shot down over Western Europe, and in fact there was probably some underclaiming, because some of those bombers that were damaged flew on and then would have been lost over the North Sea. This has been a very short overview of the German night fighters' campaign against the RAF Bomber Command in the night skies of Europe over the course of nearly 5 years. There have been literally hundreds of books written about Bomber Command, but very few about the German night fighter force. If you're interested, further reading might include these books: A History of the German Night Fighter Force Since 1917-1945 by Gebhard Eders, The Luftwaffe Data Book by Dr. Alfred Price, The Bomber Command War Diaries by Martin Middlebrook and Chris Everett, and the four volumes of the official history of Bomber Command, particularly Volume 4, which lists the statistics of the campaign. If you actually want to buy a set of the official history of Bomber Command, take out another mortgage, because you'll need it. Any questions?
Sir? Do you know the numbers of the casualties in the German bomber and night fighter?
No, I don't. The German statistics were really good up to about halfway through 1944, and after that they suffered quite dramatically. The figures are available, but I haven't got them here.
Would you be able to comment on how the night fighter campaign affected the air war on the Eastern Front? Because I've heard that it detracted from the air superiority of the Germans on the Eastern Front and enabled the Russian successes.
The Russian bomber force, strategic bomber force, did complete some raids, but they were very light and not that many aircraft were involved. The German night fighter force, there were night fighters on the Eastern Front, and they were directed mainly by controllers and radar fitted on trains. They They shot down a number of Russian aircraft, but most of the night incursions on the Eastern Front were by light aircraft in the manner of Tiger Moths, that sort of aircraft, which were very hard to track on radar, and being slow often would get overshot by the fighter. So night fighting didn't cause didn't have a huge impact on the Eastern Front, really, compared to the Western Front. And of course there were also German night fighters active from Italy, Sicily, over Malta, and at times over the desert as well.
So. In the early part of the war, I was a small boy in the north of England, and suddenly the family was gnashing their teeth and crying and wailing because cousin Tommy had been put in the tail end of a Lancaster as the tail end Charlie. Expectation of life, 3 weeks. Many years later, he died, and the only thing in his wallet was a picture of his bomber crew, and he survived 3 tours.
I had my mother's cousin was a tail gunner in Lancasters, and a good friend of mine in Auckland a number of years ago was a mid-upper gunner with Hungrit Group. Initially on Stirlings and then in Halifaxes, and they survived, but an awful lot of people did not.
Some you win, some you don't.
Sorry?
Some you win, some you don't.
Yes, exactly. You play as your money, you take your chances, basically.
Can you tell us how many missions are in a Lancaster Bomber Crew's tour?
It varied slightly during the war, but it was up to 30 raids. And given the casualty figures, the chances of you surviving it were probably 50%, something like that. And as I said, some people went on to fly two. You had to fly, if you'd flown one tour, you were then rested, usually helping with training, and then you had to fly a second tour. But then you couldn't be made to fly a third tour, but some people put their hand up, and I think they probably just got off on the excitement of it or whatever. But yeah.
In your opinion, was the scale of the bombing campaign, and given the detraction it took from other resources, just think it was justified, or could have they achieved the same ends with a smaller bomber force?
Initially, I don't think that they would have achieved the same ends with a smaller force, but towards the end of the war, with the pathfinders and the electronic aids that Bomber Command had, they were a lot more accurate with their bombing. But Harris was, Air Marshal Harris, was still dedicated to bombing the cities, and he was never that keen on bombing specific targets unless, generally speaking, he was ordered to do so.
Michael.
Dennis, what was the aircraft? You mentioned the Mosquito and the ME-1110. Were there other aircraft involved?
Yes, there were. With Hungrit Group, right at the start, they were flying bow fighters. With the Germans, of course, they were also flying Junkers 88 bombers, fitted out as night fighters, and they were quite successful too. And earlier on, Dornier bombers fitted out as night fighters. And the Junkers 88 and the Dorniers were they were good. And particularly the Junkers 88, but their main thing was that they were very heavily armed. Yeah. But some of the night fighter aces flew, particularly Junkers 88s, throughout the war. But most of the experts were flying 110s.
Dennis, can you comment on the insignia there? It's quite interesting, the Jag, the Lightning, looks like it's into UK, and then you've got the Eagle coming down. Will it be something to do with the stupid dive bombers? Or
No. It's from Fawkes family initially. It's a derivative of Fawkes family crest. And on the other side, the bore, that's the single-engine night fighters by Hayo Herman. He ran that.
Got a question up the back there.
Yeah, there's an American general who advocated going for the synthetic fuel plants rather than going for the cities first. Would that have made a difference with no fuel?
It certainly did towards in 1944 and 1945. It severely restricted the aviation fuel available to the Luftwaffe to A, fly missions, and B, more particularly for their training. You got to the stage, particularly with the day fighters, that American fighter pilots and British fighter pilots probably had about 300 hours of flight training before they were allocated the squadron, whereas the Germans were feeding their kids in with about 100 hours, and of course they were just easy meat for the day fighter, German day fighters.
So they should have got some synthetic fuel plants first.
Yeah, I mean that at the end of the day, that's what really crippled the German army as well as the navy and the air force. But equally, the bomber raids on transport, etc., also had a significant effect on the German economy.
Any other questions? Yeah.
I've always been fascinated by the amount of fuel that is required in Great Britain for all facets of the war. What countries were mainly supplying tanker loads of fuel, and what routes were they taking? Because you would have thought the Germans would have been more onto the tankers than anything else.
Most of the fuel came from the United States, and the tankers were with the convoys coming across the North Atlantic. And it was always a particular loss when the tanker was sunk, because but as you say, if you look at the number of airfields that were used and were built across the United Kingdom during the Second World War, the amount and the number of aircraft that were flying. I mean, if you look at Bomber Command, there were nights when 1,000 bombers or more were flying at various targets across Germany.
Yeah.
You also had the American day bombers, the B-17s and the Liberators. A huge, huge amount of fuel that was being used.
So I go on to say, when these tankers arrived in Great Britain, there must have been a lot of well-camouflaged fuel depots where the fuel was unloaded, that the Germans perhaps didn't know where they were.
Yeah, I would imagine that's so. I don't really know, but after the Blitz, the Germans were not that active over the United Kingdom, and they would have the Baedeker raids where they would bomb a small city like Exeter. But it wasn't a specific campaign. It was more so that the Germans could use as propaganda, "Our boys are bombing Britain."
I guess the British never ever thought about synthetic fuel like the Germans had. The scientists that can manufacture synthetic fuel, I suppose the British never ever.
Well, the Germans, of course, were heavily into the manufacture of synthetic fuel, particularly after the Ploiești in Romania. The refineries there had been bombed a number of times by the Americans, particularly. But the British never really had any need to.
By bombing the cities in the UK, left the airfields alone, didn't touch them so much.
There were several times during the war, for a very short period of time, that the Germans used in Intruder fighters across Britain. They did it again towards the end of 1944, and that was about the last time. But on each occasion, because the results were not that startling, they were ordered to come back and protect German cities.
Any others? Yeah.
Oh, just one little small diversion. I've often wondered, the German government contracted out, it seems like about 80% of all large concrete contracts to the top, TODT Corporation.
Yep.
Would that family be multi-millionaires now? If the German government to pay them back, I suppose they never get ever got the money out of them.
I don't know, but the Krupp is still going, going well, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah, I mean,
and of course Volkswagen.
So, yeah. Yeah. Don't forget they also did all the autobahns, which are still in use.
Yes.
You know, a lot of those got put down in mid 1930s, or early 1930s, in fact. Yeah.
You mentioned I think it was a rear facing radar on the British bombers, which the Germans were tracking to locate them. I hadn't heard about that. Can you give us any more information about that technology?
It was called Monica, and it was only after a German night fighter landed by mistake in the United Kingdom that the RAF found that they were tracking the emissions from Monica, which was just a tail warning radar. It just beeped if something came up behind you, and of course it was rather difficult for the tail gunners from the simple reason that, of course, they're flying in a bomber stream and there's aircraft everywhere. But the Germans could. And then after that, German night fighter was analysed in the United Kingdom. The RAF were told to switch it off. And also with the H2S bombing radar, ground tracking radar. Most of the bombers initially had left that on the whole time to help with navigation as they tracked across Germany. And they were told to switch it on when you really have to switch it on and when you don't switch it off. So, yeah.
Any other questions?
Thank you very
much. Well, thank you, Dennis.
That was
a great... Thank you.